KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. The name Muhammad is powerful and iconic, but what do we know about his life story? Leslie Hazelton brings Muhammad to life in this talk, recorded at Seattle's Town Hall on January 24th, 2013. Hazelton has written about the Middle East for The New York Times, The Nation, and Time magazine. Her most recent book is The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad.
Thank you so much.
Today, January 24th, is also the day in 2013 that Muhammad's birthday falls on. The Islamic date is Rabi al-Awwal, the 12th of Rabi al-Awwal. And, of course, the date changes each year because the Islamic calendar is lunar, so it shifts 11 days earlier each year compared to the Christian date. And this was kind of amazing. Some people think that I planned it this way or my publishers planned it this way, and I wish we had had the sense to say that that's true. But, in fact, it just happened that way. And while I don't believe in omens, I have to say that if I did believe in omens, this might be a very good one. So what I'd like to do is read a couple of sections of the book, not too long, as you heard, 25 minutes or so. And me being me, of course, they're not representative sections. In fact, they're the sections that might be called, by some of you, the most speculative, or by others, even some of you, the most presumptuous. Imagine, if you will, the sight of this agnostic Jew tussling for weeks on end trying to understand the pivotal mystical moment of Islam, which is what happened to Muhammad one night in the year 610 on a mountain just outside Mecca, Mount Hira. Tussling with it, by that I mean trying to understand exactly what happened, asking again and again, what happened that night? And once that question was formed in my mind, it wouldn't let me go. I mean, on the one hand, I knew it was an exercise in absurdity. How can I possibly understand mystical experience? How can anyone know what happened there aside from Muhammad himself? He was alone on the mountain. It felt sort of, in a sense, rather like, you know, sort of asking what's the sound of one hand clapping. So, on the other hand, there is no other hand, is there? So, having been suitably zen about it all, or unsuitably zen, because I've mixed faith metaphors like crazy, let me tell you how the book begins. If he weren't standing lonely vigil on the mountain, you might say that there was no sign of anything unusual about him. The earliest sources describe him with infuriating vagueness for those of us who need images. He was neither tall nor short, they say, neither dark nor fair, neither thin nor stout. But here and there, specific details slip through, and when they do, they're surprising. Surely a man spending night after night in solitary meditation would be a gaunt, ascetic figure. Yet far from being pale and wan, he had round, rosy cheeks and a ruddy complexion. He was stockily built, almost barrel-chested, which may partly account for his distinctive gait, always leaning forward slightly as though he were hurrying towards something. And he must have had a stiff neck, because people would remember that when he turned to look at you, he turned his whole body instead of just his head. The only sense in which he was conventionally handsome was his profile, the sweeping hawk nose, long considered a sign of nobility in the Middle East. On the surface, then, you might conclude that he was an average Meccan. At 40 years old, the son of a man he had never seen, He had made a far better life for himself than had ever seemed possible. The child, born an outsider within his own society, had finally won acceptance and carved out a good life despite the odds against him. He was comfortably off, a happily married business agent with the respect of his peers. If he wasn't one of the movers and shakers of his prosperous city, that was precisely why people trusted him to represent their interests. They saw him as a man with no axe of his own to grind, a man who would consider an offer or a dispute on his own merits and decide accordingly. He'd found a secure niche in the world, and he'd earned every right in middle age to sit back and enjoy his rise to respectability. So what was he doing alone up here on one of the mountains that ringed the sleeping city below? Why would a happily married man isolate himself this way, standing in meditation through the night? There was a hint, perhaps, in his clothing. By now he could certainly have afforded the elaborate embroidered silks of the wealthy, but his clothes were low-key. His sandals were worn, the leather thongs sun-bleached paler than his skin. His homespun robe would be almost threadbare if it hadn't been so carefully patched, and it was hardly enough to shield him against the nighttime cold of the high desert. Yet something about the way he stood on the mountainside made the cold irrelevant. Tilted slightly forward as though leaning into the wind, his stance seemed that of someone who existed at an angle to the earth. Certainly a man could see the world in a different way up here. He could find peace in the silence, with just the soughing of the wind over the rock for company, far from the feuds and gossip of the city with its arguments over money and power. Here, a man was merely a speck in the mountain landscape, his mind free to think and reflect, and then finally to stop thinking, stop reflecting, and submit itself to the vastness. Look closer, and you might detect the shadow of loneliness in the corners of his eyes, something lingering there of the outsider he'd once been, as though he were haunted by the awareness that at any moment everything he'd worked so long and hard for could be taken away. You might see a hint of that same mix of vulnerability and resoluteness in his mouth, the full lips slightly parted as he whispered into the darkness. And then, perhaps, you'd ask, why contentment was not enough? Did the fact that it had been so hard earned make him unable to accept it as a given, never to be secure in his right to it? But then what would? What was he searching for? Was it a certain peace within himself, perhaps? Or was it something more? A glimpse, maybe just an intimation, of something larger? One thing is certain. By Muhammad's own account, he was completely unprepared for the enormity of what he would experience on this particular night in the year 610. A human encounters the divine. To the rationalist, a matter not a fact, but a wishful fiction. So if Muhammad had behaved the way one might expect after his first encounter on Mount Hira, it would only make sense to call the story just that, a fable concocted by piety and belief. But he did not. He did not come floating off the mountain as though walking on air. He did not run down shouting, "Hallelujah and bless the Lord." He did not radiate light and joy. There were no choirs of angels, no music of the heavens, no elation, no ecstasy, no golden aura surrounding him, no sense of his absolute, foreordained, unquestionable role as the messenger of God. Not even the whole of the Quran fully revealed, but just five brief verses. In short, Muhammad did none of the things that might seem essential to the legend of a man who'd just done the impossible and crossed the border between this world and another. None of the things that might make it easy to cry foul. to denigrate the whole story as an invention, a cover for something as mundane as delusion or personal ambition. On the contrary, he was convinced that what had happened couldn't have been real. At best, it had to have been a hallucination, a trick of the eye or the ear or his own mind working against him. At worst, possession. He'd been seized by an evil jinn, a spirit out to deceive him, even to crush the life out of him. In fact, he was so sure that he could only be Majnun, possessed by a jinn, that when he found himself still alive, his first instinct had been to finish the job himself, to leap off the highest cliff and escape the terror of what he'd experienced by putting an end to all experience. So the man who fled down Mount Hera trembled not with joy, but with a stark primordial fear. He was overwhelmed not with conviction, but by doubt. He was sure of only one thing. Whatever this was, it was not meant to happen to him. Not to a middle-aged man who'd hoped perhaps at most for a simple moment of grace instead of this vast, blinding weight of revelation. If he no longer feared for his life, he certainly feared for his sanity, painfully aware that too many nights in solitary meditation may have driven him over the edge. Whatever happened up there on Mount Hera, the sheer humanness of Muhammad's reaction may be the strongest argument for its historical reality. Whether you think the words he heard came from inside himself or from outside, it's clear that Muhammad experienced them, and that he did so with a force that would shatter his sense of himself and his world. Terror was the only sane response. Terror and denial. And if this reaction strikes us now as unexpected, even shockingly so, that is only a reflection of how badly we've been misled by the stereotyped image of ecstatic mystical bliss. Lay aside such preconceived notions for a moment, and you might see that Muhammad's fear speaks of real experience. It sounds fallibly human. Too human for some, like conservative Muslim theologians who argue that the account of his trying to kill himself shouldn't even be mentioned, despite the fact that it's in the earliest Islamic biographies. They insist that he never doubted for even a single moment, let alone despaired. Demanding perfection, they cannot tolerate human imperfection. And perhaps this is why it can be so hard to see who Muhammad really was. The purity of perfection denies the complexity of a lived life. For Muslims worldwide, Muhammad is the ideal man, the prophet, the messenger of God. And though he's told again and again in the Quran to say, "I'm just one of you, just a man," reverence and love cannot resist the desire to clothe him, as it were, in gold and silver. There's a proprietary feeling about him, a fierce protectiveness, all the stronger at a time when Islam itself is under such intense scrutiny in the West. But the law of unintended consequences applies. To idealize someone is also, in a way, to dehumanize them. So that despite the millions, if not billions, of words written about Muhammad, it can be hard to get any real sense of the man himself. The more you read, the more I read, I should have said, the more liable you are to come away with the feeling that while you may know a lot about him, you still don't know who he really was. It's as though he's been all but smothered by the accumulated mass of so many words. So though the reverential legends about him are often magnificent, they work as perhaps all legends do. They obscure as much as they reveal, and he becomes more a symbol than a human being. So even as Islam is rapidly closing on Christianity as the world's largest religion, we have little real sense of the man told three times in the Quran to call himself the first Muslim. His is without doubt one of the most consequential lives ever lived. Yet for all the iconic power of his name, or perhaps because of it, it's a life still to be explored.
Leslie Hazelton, the author of The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on January 24th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
We'll hear more from Leslie Hazelton in just a minute. It's 8:21.
In the claustrophobia of a New York apartment, Mel Edison is having a nervous breakdown.
I'm unraveling and I'm losing touch.
You haven't been sleeping well lately.
I don't know where I am half the time.
The Prisoner of Second Avenue by Neil Simon, starring Richard Dreyfuss and Marsha Mason, next time on LA Theatre Works.
LA Theatre Works tomorrow night at 10. Here on 94.9 KUOW News and Information. I'm Rainey Cohen. Thanks for being with us tonight. They say that hope springs eternal, but in the case of the Seattle Mariners, hope has been hard to come by in recent years. The Hometown Nine haven't made the playoffs since 2001. So what does 2013 hold for the Mariners? We'll get a spring training preview tomorrow morning at 9.
If you do something good, or say you do something really bad, who do you tell? And who can you call at 3 in the morning and know they're going to pick up? On the next Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, Close Knit. Amazing stories about those who matter most. Do not miss it.
Snap Judgment, Sunday afternoon at 2. Overnight tonight, cloudy skies with areas of fog and a low of 41 degrees. Morning clouds and fog tomorrow, then mostly sunny skies by the afternoon with highs in the low to mid 50s. For the weekend, on Saturday, clouds and showers likely through most of the day, a high of 47. And on Sunday, mostly sunny by the afternoon, highs in the mid to upper 40s.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. Leslie Hazelton is a Middle East scholar who has written extensively about Islam. Her new book is called The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on January 24, 2013. Next, she talks about Muhammad's early life and how he grew up as an orphan.
His father never even knew that he had sired a son. After he married Muhammad's mother, he went off on a journey, fell ill, never returned. And this is not a new fact. It's been mentioned by many other biographers before, but this is the problem. It's just been mentioned and then skipped over as though it was just a minor detail that had no effect on the man who Muhammad would grow up to be. And it seems to me key to understanding who he was. This was a child, even though he was born into the ruling tribe of Mecca, he was born way on the margins of it by virtue of being an orphan. So he was an outsider within the inside ruling tribe. And the rest of his childhood went on from there. It was not what you would call an auspicious childhood. He was sent away for 5 years to a Bedouin foster family. And when he was returned to Mecca, he knew his mother for less than 1 year until she also died. And he watched her die. He was six. From then on, he was shunted from household to household. He was put to work as a camel boy on the huge trade caravans from Mecca, north to Damascus, and south to the Yemen, and gradually worked his way up to become a business agent and married Khadija, his first wife. And this is a marriage that I know comes as quite a surprise to many people, because it was a loving, monogamous relationship that lasted 24 years until her death. The nine wives he subsequently married, the late life wives, in the last 10 years of his life, were mainly diplomatic alliances of the kind that any leader at the time had to make. But when he was married to Khadija, he was not yet a leader. In fact, he was struggling for acceptance. Now, all of this, of course, is the barest bones, in fact, the shadows of barest bones of several chapters. But my point here is that this training in being an outsider, as I see it, was essential to understanding not only who Muhammad was, but also why he was able to see so clearly what was happening in Mecca, which was a kind of 7th century Arabian equivalent of a Wall Street bull market. And we know what happens with that, right? With all the greed and the corruption and everything. And thus to the formation, once he began to get the revelations, what they represented was a radical challenge to the status quo of Mecca and to the ruling elite. So by chapter 7, I finally worked my way back to where I began, to that night on the mountain when he's 40 years old. And here is where I start seriously gnawing at the question that so fascinated me. As he climbed the familiar path, following tracks made by mountain goats, Mecca receded beneath him. He knew the mountain well by now, its hidden hollows and crevices part of the landscape of retreat, and by dusk he was standing in his usual place. He leaned forward into the wind, though there was barely a hint of a breeze as the last birds darted for home. As the darkness thickened, so too did the silence. The kind of absolute silence that rings in the ears, a high, perfect tone that comes from everywhere and nowhere. A vibration more than a sound, really, as though the whole landscape is sentient. The rock itself seems to be alive as it releases the accumulated warmth of daytime into the cool of night. And as the stars begin their slow revolution overhead, there comes that sense of being a human all alone, and yet inexorably part of something larger. A sense of life and existence far older and deeper than the superficial ambitions and everyday cruelties of human affairs. Did Muhammad stand in simple gratitude for the ordinary human happiness that had been granted him against all expectation? Or was there a certain watchfulness about him, as though he were waiting for something about to happen? We only know that if it was peace he was seeking, what he experienced that night would be anything but. What actually happened on Mount Hira? We have what appear to be Muhammad's own words, but they come relayed through others at several removes, with each narrator struggling to translate the ineffable into terms they could understand. One account is credited to Aisha, the youngest and the most outspoken of the wives he would marry after Khadija's death. This is Khadija speaking. Aisha speaking. He said, "When the angel came to me, I had been standing, but I fell to my knees and crawled away, my shoulders trembling. I thought of hurling myself down from a mountain crag, but he appeared to me as I was thinking this and said, 'Muhammad, I am Gabriel, and you are the messenger of God.' Then he said, 'Recite.' I said, 'What shall I recite?' He took me and pressed me tightly 3 times until I was nearly stifled and thought that I should die. And then he said, 'Recite in the name of thy Lord who created man from a clot of blood, that thy Lord is the most bountiful, who teaches by the word, teaches man what he knew not.'" The first revealed verse of the Quran. The narrative continues in words credited to one of Muhammad's future followers, Ibn Zubayr, who again quotes him directly. "I recited it, and the angel desisted and departed. I woke up, and it was as though these words had been engraved on my heart." But there was none of God's creation more hateful to me than a poet or a madman. I could not bear to look at either of them, yet I thought I must be either a poet or a madman. But if so, none will ever say this of me. I shall take myself to a mountain cliff, hurl myself down from it, and find respite in death. But when I came near the top of the mountain, I heard a voice from heaven saying, Muhammad, you are the messenger of God. I raised my head to see who was speaking, and there Gabriel was in the form of a man, with feet astride the horizon. I stood looking at him, and this distracted me from what I had intended, and I could go neither forward nor back. I turned my face away from him to all points of the horizon, but wherever I looked, I saw him in exactly the same form. This, Aisha would say, was a true vision. But the form it took in her mouth and those of others is clumsily flat. These were well-intentioned people trying to find words for a state of being they'd never experienced. And in the process, they simplified it, turning the metaphysical into the merely physical, as in that image of the angel Gabriel straddling the mountains. It's as though the moment itself were cloaked, as though too close an account of what happened that night were beyond human comprehension, which is in fact exactly how Muhammad experienced it. Where his reported words come to life is not in the angelic apparition, but in that palpable feeling of terror, that panicked disorientation, that sundering of everything familiar, that feeling of being utterly overwhelmed to the point of near death by a force larger than anything the mind can comprehend. In short, a terrible awe. Now, this may be difficult to grasp today when the word awesome is used to describe a new app or a viral video. And God awful is casually attached to a rotten movie or a bad meal. With the exception, perhaps, of a massive earthquake, we're protected from real awe. Few people even know any longer what it's like to stand alone in a thunderstorm on the open plains, or to feel the shore vibrate beneath you as a gale sends billions of tons of water pounding in across thousands of miles of ocean. We close the doors and hunker down, convinced that we're in control, or at least hoping for control, and lose touch of what it is to be overwhelmed by a force much greater than ourselves. How, then, to understand Muhammad's awe? Something that is metaphysical, beyond the physical, is by definition beyond rational explanation. Yet while the attempt to reconstruct mystical experience may well be absurd, one can at least be a fool for trying. I can at least be a fool for trying. rather than a different kind of fool for not trying. Rudolf Otto, the great Victorian scholar of comparative religion, may have come close in his book, The Idea of the Holy. Does anyone know that book? The Idea of... Oh, shame. Okay, you're going to hear a little bit of it. Albeit in the rather overly impassioned language of his era. The fear of God in the Hebrew Bible, he wrote, seizes upon man with paralyzing effect. Job experienced, quote, a terror fraught with an inward shuddering such as not even the most menacing and overpowering created thing can instill. It has something spectral in it. And he really did mean spectral. In ghost stories, he continues, the sense of dread makes you shudder, going so deep that it seems to penetrate to the very marrow, making a man's hair bristle and his limbs quake. Yet by comparison with what he called numinous consciousness, the awareness of divine will and power, this ghostly shudder is child's play. At its highest level, he wrote, dread reappears in a form ennobled beyond measure, where the soul, held speechless, trembles inwardly to the furthest fiber of its being. There's nothing remotely blissful about such an experience, Otto emphasized, throwing in a sly dig at those who cling to the idea of revelation as ecstatic by concluding that the singularly daunting and awe-inspiring character of such a moment must be gravely disturbing to those who will recognize nothing in the divine nature but goodness, gentleness, love, and a sort of confidential intimacy. But if we don't need to be as purple-prosed as Rudolf Otto, neither do we have to be as literal as Aisha or Ibn Zubair. We don't need to insist that Muhammad actually heard Gabriel speaking as though the angel were a human being, let alone reduce Muhammad to the status of a divinely appointed voice recorder playing back what was dictated to him. Since we are rational products of the 21st century, we might look instead to science for an explanation, calling on neuropsychiatry and the idea of altered states of consciousness. Was Muhammad in such an altered state that night on Mount Hira? Of course he was. But neurological research has only revealed what ascetics and mystics have always known, that practices such as fasting, sleep deprivation, and intense meditation can induce such states, which are accompanied by changes in the brain's chemical activity. The fact that an altered state of consciousness has a physical correlate should come as no surprise, since brain chemistry parallels experiential input. But to then imagine that everything is explained by chemistry is to fall into the reductive trap of what William James called medical materialism, which dismisses experience in favor of mechanics. While science can chart the physical effects of such altered states, it cannot enter the experience of them. In the end, the most practical way to pursue the question may be the one that at first glance might seem the least practical of all, by making the leap into poetry. The essence of religious experience is at heart poetic. Ritual and dogma are merely the framework of organized religion, its girders, as it were. They do not touch on religious experience itself, which is the experience of mystery, of the indescribably enigmatic. Poetry pivots on enigma, which naturally has not prevented many poets from trying to define it nonetheless. Walt Whitman called the beauty of poems the tuft and final applause of science, which is a nicely phrased response to medical materialism. Coleridge talked of, you'll know this one, the willing suspension of disbelief for the moment, which constitutes poetic faith, while Ralph Waldo Emerson called poetry the endeavor to express the spirit of the thing. Note the words used here, faith and spirit. But the most apt definition of poetry may be the anonymous one, saying something that cannot be said, which again is no reason not to try. If we look at the metaphors in the account of Muhammad on the mountain, it may be possible to at least begin to understand. Start then with the idea of inspiration, which is literally the act of breathing in or of being breathed into. The Arabic word for both breath and spirit is ruh, close kin to the Hebrew ruach. So the idea of having spirit breathed into you is thus built into the language, as it is in the second verse of Genesis, where the breath of God, ruach Elohim, lay upon the waters. But while this may sound wonderful in principle, consider that a human being is not water. Imagine being breathed into, inspired, with such force that your body can hardly bear it. No gentle breath from heaven here, but air being impelled into your lungs under immense pressure, as though a giant were giving you mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. It feels like every cell of your body is overtaken by it, and you are entirely at its mercy. Even as it gives you life, it seems to be squashing the life out of you, suffocating you under its enormous weight until it's useless to even think of fighting against it. And then consider the real meaning of that phrase of Muhammad's, as though these words were engraved on my heart. If this is by now a cliche, consider it afresh as he used it, and you begin to grasp its impact. If you've read Franz Kafka's story In the Penal Colony, you'll think instantly of the prisoner suffering the words of his penitence being carved letter by letter into his flesh. Imagine then the unimaginable. The agonizing pain of a sharp blade carving deep inside you as you lie beneath it, conscious but unable even to struggle against it. There is no unearthly calm here. Instead, it has all the violence of open-heart surgery, the wrenching apart of the chest, the baring of the heart, the unutterable pain, all in the name of a new lease on life. Muhammad was left cowering on the ground, depleted. Covered in sweat, yet shivering, he was inhabited by those words that were his and yet not his. The words he'd repeated out loud into the thin, pure air of the mountain, into the emptiness and into the darkness. Maybe he sensed somewhere inside him that these words could only come to life, could only achieve reality when spoken into the face of, breathed in by another human being. The one person he could run to for consolation in the face of this overwhelming force, who could perhaps save him from both the fear of madness and the fear of the divine, Khadija. Or perhaps at first there were no words at all. Perhaps it took time for experience to form into something as human and tangible as words. We know that he came stumbling down the mountain, slipping and sliding on the loose scree, his breath hot and rasping, each inhalation needing to be struggled for until it felt like his chest would burst with the effort of it. His robe was torn, his arms and legs scratched and bruised by thorns and sharp-edged rocks in the path of his headlong flight for home. "I have been in fear for my life," was the first thing he said. "I think I must have gone mad." Trembling, shuddering almost convulsively, he begged Khadija to hold him and hide him under her shawl. Cover me," he pleaded, his head in her lap like a small child seeking shelter from the terrors of the night. And that terror alone was enough to convince her that what her husband had experienced was real. She held him, cradled him as the night sky began to grow pale in the east with the reassuring prospect of day. Slowly, haltingly, the words he had perhaps felt more than heard began to find physical shape in his mouth. Even as he still shook in Khadija's arms, Muhammad found his voice, and the first revelation of the Quran formed into words that another human being could hear. What had been breathed into him up on the mountain was now breathed out to take its place in the world. Ah, thank you.
Leslie Hazelton, the author of The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on January 24th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
It's 8:46.
I'm Bob Garfield. On this week's On the Media, we dissect a cluster of media mistakes. An Esquire magazine story that claims the Navy SEAL who killed Osama bin Laden has no health coverage. He does. A Washington Post story that heralds free Wi-Fi for all. Not true. And new evidence that Truman Capote finessed some parts of In Cold Blood. Truth and Lies on the next On the Media from WNYC.
On the Media, Sunday night at 6 o'clock. I'm Rainey Cohen. This is 94.9 KUOW News and Information. Reporters for This American Life spent 5 months at Harper High School in Chicago. Last year alone, 29 current and recent students were shot. The reporters went to get a sense of what it means to live in the midst of all this gun violence, how teens and adults navigate a world of funerals and homecoming dances. Stories from Harper High School, Saturday morning at 11.
Next time in Studio 360, some advice from the country music superstar Dwight Yoakam.
Man can't really steal your field of wheat overnight, but he can sure take a lot of sheep, cattle.
Dwight Yoakam on music, movies, and agriculture. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Well, I'm a honky-tonk man.
Sunday night at 7.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. Middle East scholar Leslie Hazelton has a new biography called The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. She spoke about her book at Seattle's Town Hall on January 24th, 2013. Next, she takes questions from the audience.
I'm just wondering if in your explorations of this, if you could share any insights or perhaps speculations about why people viewed this story as credible and it gained such traction. I mean, people have experiences of the divine around the world historically from the beginning. So do you have any insight from your reading about why did this one stick?
Why do we believe
yes.
it really was revelation?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, this is a long and complicated answer. That was a short question. Good point. First of all, there's no way in English that one can possibly express the beauty of the Quranic Arabic, the musicality of it, the assonance, the rhythmic quality of it. It's amazing. There's simply no way you can do it. It's built into the language. It's built into... partly it comes from pre-Islamic poetry, but it's even higher than that. And it was especially unusual coming from a man such as he. He'd been known to be rather terse, inward-looking, shy, not outgoing at all. And suddenly here he was repeating these amazing words. But it wasn't just the music of it, it was also the message. It was a radical call for equality, for social, what we now call social justice, at a time when it was nouveau riche Mecca, and it was the ruling class, the elite, were firmly in charge, and everybody else was. And Bedouin from all around, there'd been drought years, and they'd been coming into the city, as people still do all over the world. They get driven off their lands by drought or by their land being bought up. This whole spiral of debt comes and they get forced off their land and forced into the big cities where they become this kind of underclass. And this is exactly what was happening in Mecca in the late 6th and early 7th century. And his message spoke to basically the 99%. It was a very, very, very strong message of social justice to rise up. At the same time, of course, it was a message of unity, of bringing everybody together under this umbrella of the one God, who already existed, by the way. Allah, the shrine in Mecca, was the shrine to Allah. And the ruling tribe profited off this too. They were not only excellent merchants. I mean, they were huge, these camel caravans. These trading caravans, like 2,000 camels at a time. This was no, and they were extremely well organized I've described it in the book. But But at the same time as they were profiting off trade, they were also profiting off faith. Because the Kaaba was the shrine to the one God. It wasn't yet called the Kaaba because it wasn't yet a cube. It would become that very soon. It was the shrine to the one God, Allah, who is the same God as the Hebrew Elohim or the Sumerian or Phoenician El, same root, the high one, El, Allah. Only this was a God you couldn't touch. This was a God so remote you couldn't see this God, you couldn't touch this God, you couldn't speak to this God, which is partly why Muhammad was in such fear and trembling on the mountain. So there were all kinds of other gods, sort of like junior gods, as it were. And you'll find this throughout polytheism, by the way, that there's always a senior god, Zeus, you know, and then all the whole family beneath him and so on. Jupiter, all the family beneath him and so on. And these are approachable. These are intercessors and so on. These, and in Mecca, they were mainly stones, very beautiful, you know, outstanding stones, stones that for one reason or another stood out in the desert. And you could touch them. You could pour offerings on them, libations on them, and so on. You could sacrifice in front of them, you know, a sheep or a goat. You could pray to them. And of course, you know, part of monotheism is that no partners with God, no associates with God, no junior associates. So this message of unity was very, very powerful given this whole social, cultural, and religious background. I told you it would be a long answer. I'm sorry.
I was raised as a Muslim in a country in Eastern Europe. And when I saw this in the newspaper in Seattle Times that there was a book reading about Muhammad or his biography, I wonder why Muhammad, that's the question I ask myself, why did you choose Muhammad? Why his biography?
I'm sorry to laugh, but I mean, yeah, because I get asked that question so often. And when I'm asked it by Muslims, I almost want to say, how not? You know, I mean, truly one of the most remarkable lives ever lived. And yet here in the West, we know so little about him. And part of the reason, I think, is that... part of the reason I wrote this book is because I really simply wanted to know who he really was. I write out of my own desire to know. And what I had read about him, and I'd read many biographies of him as part of the research for my previous book, After the Prophet, which was about the origins of this immense saga behind the Shia-Sunni split. But none of them gave me a real sense for the man himself. They were kind of... At best, the sort of modern ones were what I might describe as dutiful. They were kind of dry.
I'm sure it will be truly appreciated the way it should be.
So. The way it should be, I don't know. I mean, the way it should be in the eyes of Muslims,
so.
I really don't know. You know, you really might call it an agnostic biography, mm-hmm. since I am an agnostic. I don't take a position there. But what I have done is gone back to the sources, to the earliest Islamic biographies of Ibn Ishaq, which was written late 8th, early 9th century, and al-Tabari, which was 9th, 10th century. And they are wonderful. You read those, and all the juice and the vitality of real life comes through in them. You know, there's people speaking about what they remember and what they saw and so on. And that's, of course, where those descriptions that I gave at the beginning of what Muhammad looked like came from. They came from people who were there. And only those are very difficult for Westerners to read because they're written in very classical Middle Eastern style. There's no straight linear chronology. You don't begin, middle, and end. You begin here, and you sort of go here, and then this one comes in here, and then that one comes in here, and you know, it's a whole different way of storytelling, and it's one I happen to love, because I lived in the Middle East for a long time, and sort of sat at the feet of storytellers as they would tell stories this way. But I know it's one that drives most Westerners crazy. So, So I have relied heavily on these wonderful men who lived in Damascus and Baghdad more than 1,300 years ago. And, of course, on the Quran itself.
Hi. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for staying over here.
That was really wonderful. Thank you. I couldn't help but make some parallels to a story from another piece of sacred scripture, and that is the New Testament, when the angel comes to Mary. Now, she takes it, as it's told, beautifully and placidly, and your description of the terror of actually having an angel come and changing one's life. Can you comment on the two different perspectives?
That's so strange, because I hadn't made that connection. You know, I wrote a biography of Mary. A flesh and blood biography, there's the subtitle. And I remember there writing that, you know, sort of Christianity depends on Mary's radical yes. That she said yes to the angel. She could have said no. She could have said, no way, I'm out of here. Don't want any of this. She didn't. She said yes. But we don't have... The difference is that that was... I mean, that whole book obviously was much more speculative because we don't have Mary's voice relayed by people who were there. It was really an act of recreating, of imagining her, using all the sources I could possibly get my hands on, using history and Middle East studies and anthropology and my own experience in the Middle East and a strong sense of place and time and how people lived and archaeology and so on. And all these I've used with this book too, of course. But with the story of Muhammad, there is an immense amount of information there. The question is, sifting through it. You get the same story told, for instance, in Ibn Ishaq or in Al-Tabari. From the same event can be told 12, even 20 times in the voice, in different voices, different people. And of course, all these different accounts are going to clash with each other here and there. But you can feel, if you've ever lived in the Middle East especially, you can feel when they're real. You can sense when it's a real person talking. And you can sense when it's been overwritten later as an act of devotion or piety and so on. So it's a matter of sensing it out, of sifting through it. And I guess, you know, my background as a psychologist comes in useful here too. But that sense, you know, I'm always searching for that sense of the real, of something I can touch that's real, that makes sense to me. And this I found a lot in these ancient, what seem to us ancient, actually not so ancient, early Muslim biographers and historians.
Leslie Hazelton, the author of The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. She spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on January 24th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
It's just before 9 o'clock. NPR News headlines are coming up next. Today's KUOW Day sponsor is Floyd Nordstrom, wishing Marianne a happy Valentine's Day birthday. Today's other KUOW Day sponsors are Bill and Susie Thornis, recognizing Solarize Seattle. Their next free solar workshop is February 20th in Ballard.
Ron Rash's stories and novels are often set in Appalachia, but readers everywhere will glimpse something familiar.
The writers I love most have been able to find the universal in the particular. Eudora Welty once said, "One place understood helps us understand all other places better."
Ron Rash's short stories, Nothing Gold Can Stay, Saturday on the Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.